Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scott Hertz over here in the other chair.
The other chair. Oh, so humble.
The one that, yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, Lord.
Well, it's not the other chair, it's the actual controller chair of which the thing is produced for the show.
I am at the controls.
That's all the technical talk I know.
Slider. They call me the slider. Hope that's not something rude. I'm sorry.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of the screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today, we will look at Bombardier, who last week sold 45 planes to Air Canada on the heels of laying off 7,000 workers, more than a third of them in Quebec alone. Is it time for the government to give up on Bombardier, or are those well-paying aerospace jobs worth it? Then we will talk about a legal matter involving Apple, who has until tomorrow to respond to a court order from the FBI to hack open the iPhone belonging to one of the two San Bernardino shooters who were killed last December. Is Apple pushing a legal fight in the name of privacy, or are the feds being reasonable in their requests? And then finally, we will talk about the Grexit sequel, Brexit, and whether or not the United Kingdom is set to leave the European Union behind in a referendum to be held this June. Before we get into the first topic, I just wanted to make a note. Yes, we do know that the Ontario budget is dropped today. Unfortunately, it was announced at 4 p.m., which really doesn't give us enough time to parse it.
They won't listen to us. They won't do these things earlier in the day. You know, we've tried, but...
Well, the lockup for the Guelph, for the Ontario budget, it's like 7 hours long. And if you don't know what the lockup is, it's they have like stakeholders and media. They put them in a locked room.
Bring a snack.
Of course.
Oh, catered.
Well, yeah, no, it is catered. They bring
why are
lunch.
We doing this?
And where they have like several hours to go over the budget. And then at 4 p.m., it's the speech is made in front of the, what do you call it, Queen's Park. Anyway, we know that's going on, but we'll have to reserve the portion where we talk about it and pull it apart and look at the elements for next week.
We're going to have our own lockup.
We should have
fries.
Our own lockup.
Some fries.
We're going to have a lockup in Center 6.
Yeah, exactly.
or the Stone Road Mall food court.
Have to do that.
Yeah. But first topic this week, the Duffy trial reached its inevitable conclusion. Closing arguments were made Monday and Tuesday from the Crown and the defense. The judge is going to bring about his verdict sometime around the end of April. But for now, it seems like Duffy's fate is relatively uncertain because, I mean, some good points were made by the Crown. On the other hand, the defense pointed out, I think understandably and justly, that this probably wasn't as prosecuted as tightly as it could have been. There are holes in the case, not the least of which is they brought the bribee to court and not the bribers.
The bribee and the bribers. That sounds so legal. Sounds so legalese, but it's true. You're right.
I went to law school with book
yeah,
learning.
Yeah, bribulation.
Bribulation.
We just coined a new phrase. There you go. Yeah, this is one of those things. It has exposed, of course, a lot of what's gone on in terms of impropriety in the Senate, in terms of spending of money and just sort of willy-nilly throwing cash around. Mm-hmm. You will recall, because this is sort of a review of a thing we've been talking about for years. We talked about it on the old show. It's that long that it became clear that the money was just sort of being spread around. And Duffy, probably the major fall guy in terms of let's see what charges we can make stick. And it sounds like that's what the Crown is hoping for, at least according to Duffy's lawyer, in mm-hmm. that they it's like we're going to charge him with all this stuff and we'll hope that something sticks. And maybe, you know, if there's a bit of a – what do they call it? An error of law. They were hoping that there'll be some sort of something that will trip it all up and he will get convicted of something. But by the sounds of it, and as sketchy as the check was and as shady as a lot of it seemed, he probably didn't really break the rules.
Yeah.
Just simply because there didn't really seem to be any rules. Like, well, what do we do in this case? I don't know. One of the main – well, there was a few things, the traveling for business – or Senate business and incorporating personal. They're trying to imply that He went somewhere on Senate business, but he was really just going to whip up interest in the Conservative Party, as far as I could tell. Mm-hmm. And they went to see his daughter in a play. You know, those kinds of things. And it added up. And then, of course, we had the Nigel Wright check. And I love the comment on Nigel Wright as the witness. The lawyer was saying that he had never seen a less reliable witness in 44 years of being a lawyer. It's been a lawyer as long as I've been alive. I guess you got to present the goods. But that was sort of we were expecting a lot when Wright came to stand. It was very kind of – it didn't really fizzle, but it was just kind of – especially when he did play the faith card there. It was like, you know what? You got a lot of money. You paid for this guy. But I still don't think Duffy's going to go down with anything particular.
No.
Really. They might – he might get some kind of reprimand. I don't know what charges that would be, but – it's just going to be kind of like, you guys really should look into the way the Senate runs its expenses, which they are going to do.
Yeah, Donald Blaine called it a slapdash prosecution case, and he's not wrong. And, you know, to bring it back to a local trial, I mean, it does seem like what happened with the Sona trial, where it was just like they threw everything at it possible, every possible contingency.
We're going to get you.
And it's like, you got to be guilty of something. Like, because he has 31 charges. And, you know, it could have easily been, you know, probably maybe 3 or 4 or 5. You know, they didn't have to level 31 charges against him to get the point across. Because if he's found guilty of one, he's suspended from the Senate without pay immediately. So it really does seem like they're just like bowing to public pressure, and that's understandable. I mean, you know, there were a lot of people pretty upset, and that's the flip side of this is that people don't seem to be as upset anymore. They were saying like in the courtroom there was actually plenty of room to sit in the courtroom for the closing arguments, which was a far cry from the opening arguments where they had to open a second courtroom for the overflow, and it seems like all the wind in this trial is gone because the conservatives aren't in power anymore, and the liberal government has made moves to try and make it a more egalitarian Senate, or at least a better organized Senate. And it just seems like, I mean, no one cares anymore. And considering the fervor there was at the beginning, and it's just curious.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that was to do with the fact that they were still the government at that point. And now the Harper conservatives are gone, and it's kind of like that aspect of it is a non-issue. And there's still the spending issue, which is very strong and should still be on. You know, they did say they were going to make some changes, but, you know, it's all talk until they say, okay, here's the committee, and we're going to do this. You can claim this. You can't claim that. What I think in a lot of ways was worse, there was, as I mentioned, 30 under scrutiny. Mm-hmm. Then we came down to the four, who were Pamela Wallin, Patrick Bazot,
Mac Harb.
Just want to say Mac Harb to please the conservatives out there. Mac Harb, Mac Harb. How dare he retire and just walk away from everything. And Mike Duffy. So three conservatives, one liberal. And I honestly think in some ways Pamela Wallin's was worse because it was more money. She was definitely double dipping to put a local spin on it. She was here giving away diplomas at the University of Guelph and claiming Senate expenses.
Yeah.
She's like, oops, accounting, blah, blah. Sorry. Pays back whatever it was. I think it was $150,000, somewhere in that realm.
Yeah.
She's back in the Senate.
Oh, yeah.
Go like this. Hands clean, trouble free. I'm back at work. At work doing what? Right, that's part of the burning question as well. Doing what? So it was more cash. I think she did more impropriety because in Duffy's case, it wasn't quite pork barreling, but it was definitely cronyism. He's paying his pal Donahue to surf the net and give him advice on exercising, just this stuff. It's like and the contracting firm Donahue's, I think it was the wife and son, right?
It definitely wasn't sketchy. It was sketchy.
It was sketchy, but were any rules broken? It sounds like it wasn't because, you know, it's probably been going that way since 1867, right? I'll just pay so-and-so to do this. It sounds like it was a slush fund, right?
Well, that's a term somebody used, actually.
Yeah. I think slush fund was actually from the Crown.
Yeah, a slush fund scheme.
Yeah. But was it illegal?
you know, that is
it is interesting that that was the kind of the crux of the counter argument from Donald Bain, and is that well, he didn't break the rules. There were no rules. He was just he was an innocent. He was just following the lead of everyone else, and it seems like that's
I was born in a small town. Yeah, yeah, that whole narrative of
I mean, just in legal, yeah, in terms of legal tradition, I don't think everyone else was doing it has ever been an acceptable excuse. But
no.
But still, having said that, I mean, it's I mean, we're it almost sounds like we're forgiving him, but he wasn't a blameless baby in all this.
No,
Mike Duffy. I mean, he wanted desperately to be in the Senate. That's been well chronicled. The things he was expensing, he knew he
the makeup job or whatever was one of them, right?
And he knew he was in trouble. He went and tried to get a PEI health card, even though he probably has never had one in his life. So he knew he was being painted into a corner rather than just coming clean and saying, you know. People are forgiving, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of just saying, okay, I maybe went a bit overboard. I apologize. I'm paying back the 90th. I mean, it was the obstinance. And I remember when this started leaking out and there was an event somewhere and the media was lined up outside ready to, like, scrum him and throw questions at him. And he's, like, making a joke about it. He's like, oh, my old friends in the media want to burn me alive.
Was that when he was in the kitchen or whatever?
Yeah.
It was a weird sort of altercation in the kitchen.
Yeah, it was.
It's exactly what he used to do, right? Yeah.
Well, that's what he, yeah.
It's like cut his teeth.
I'm speaking of the old show. I mean, I do remember talking about that. It's like if the shoe was on the other foot, Duffy would be enjoying roasting Duffy the senator on a spit, because this is the kind of stuff he kind of rolled with when he was an Ottawa reporter. But
pure gravy for the beat reporter, eh? It's like,
oh, yeah.
get the jaws in there and don't let go until somebody's either apologizing or stepping down. I mean, yeah, it's good stuff for to keep the story going. But it's so I guess we have another, well, April, so like a couple months to wait. So
yeah, it's like six weeks.
And then it'll come and go, and it'll just be Duffy's not really. I think they're probably going to say, well, you know, he's not the healthiest fella, but yeah, like you said, one charge or whatever, and he's done pretty much. He won't be able to go, and I think that's definitely a first, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'd be surprised if he got jail time, but then again, I would be surprised when Michael Sono got jail time. So.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, I just mention it briefly before moving on to Bombardier, is there was the mention before Christmas, and I mean, you know, we were a bit, you know, busy with, you know, stuff before Christmas to address us properly. I think it was even after we did the last live show, but when he was on the stand, Duffy, he did mention that it was a conservative operation, those robocalls in Saanich Gulf Islands, that were directing people to vote for the NDP candidate who had stepped off the ballot, but whose name was still on the ballot because it was past the deadline. And I think that's a huge story that was missed.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope if whatever the verdict comes back, that
somebody chase that down.
Yeah.
But it's funny, if you go to it, and it's a great website, mikeduffy.ca, just check it out. Because it's got a lot of these colorful 8x10s of him just sort of like one checking his watch and looking at his BlackBerry, and then one of him when he was the
action shots.
Cub reporter with a high school newspaper or whatever. But there's also an article, and I didn't read it, and I'm actually surprised it's still up in plain view, is Why I Am a Conservative.
Oh.
So I don't know. Like, I don't know if there's any spin there in terms of, like, I'm not really a Harper conservative, but definitely if you're interested, check out his website. It's interesting to look at because it's the best. I've done nothing wrong. Everything's great, and
it's
every
so
article, every article is like, you know, I'm walking from this.
It's like a teenage girl's website.
Yes, just, you know, yes. It just needs more.
Yeah.
Color.
It's like, I love JT, and I like to swim. I like to hang out with my friends at Pizza Hut. And...
But if anything, check out the photos because they are priceless. Absolutely priceless.
Also priceless is Bombardier's participation in Canada's aerospace sector. Or is it? Anyway, last week, and we did touch on this, I think, when we were talking about first 100 days of the Trudeau government, Bombardier cut 7,000 jobs. That's going to be over the next couple of years. 2,800 of them, I think, are in Quebec. Another 500, give or take, is in Ontario, and the rest are international. But this came right on the heels, almost like within less than an hour, I think, of them announcing a deal with Air Canada to buy several of these C-Series jets that Bombardier hasn't been able to actually roll off the assembly line yet. This is the first major order from a North American carrier for the C-Series. But I think we did talk about it last week, just the sheer ass slaps and high fives of
that's right.
of the first press conference where you're like, yeah, we got the deal. We're going to work with Air Canada, yo, and we're going to put together these planes. And then, of course, the press asked, well, what about the 7,000 jobs you just cut? Well, we're going to talk about that later.
Put on sad face and sit at the table. Happy faces, and then we're going to go for lunch.
Yeah.
And then put on the sad faces. Yeah, I used to, I think I've spoken about this before, but all the time on the working week, it was job cuts would be announced, and in particular the internationals, and they're large job cuts, like 7,000. The stock price immediately goes up.
Right.
It immediately goes up because that's their way of, you know, the code for it is like, we're creating efficiencies and we will be more competitive in the global, blah, blah, blah. Just plug it into the corporate BS generator and you will get exactly what was said in French and in English at that press conference. But it's getting a bit ridiculous with Bombardier. I think the grand total, if you include, oh, what was the name of the company that they absorbed as well? They bought, it was the other major, if you add up the Bombardier yeah. plus the company that they absorbed, and the name will come to me.
Yeah.
I think the grand total over the past 40 plus years that they've been bought out for is like $5 billion. Mm-hmm. Now, they were making a profit. They were making a huge profit, but Bombardier is profitable. It's not like they're losing money.
No.
I think their profit in the fourth quarter was something around $5 billion, and before that, like for the year, was probably $18.2 billion. They are not losing money. And normally we have things like bailouts and that. It's a company that's in the toilet, but they want to save it. And this is the thing with Bombardier. It's not a case of it being too big to fail, but because it's such a Canadian icon, these people invented the snowmobile. Like, yeah. They didn't just build snowmobiles. Bombardier himself invented it. Very interesting story. So it's iconic. They're trying to preserve this icon of Canada, which they couldn't do with the Avro. Speaking of aerospace, but that's a whole other story, right?
Well done.
Well, it's true though. I mean, it's that there was different pressures on them to do that, and but so what makes Bombardier so important? It's people from the West. A great article by Jen Gerson in the Post. Just and she was being a bit sarcastic, I think, when she said you should just nationalize it, which is a lefty solution. But funny enough, what was announced today is that the C-Series deal, which is something to the tune of $3.8 billion, I think, total, it sounds like the families, which is Bombardier, and I can't remember the name of the other family, the Bombardier family.
Oh, I wrote that down.
Family controlled. We'll have to kind of cede a bit of control to the government. So this is going to be a separate board of directors within the company that will oversee this wing of it. So
Bullion? Yeah.
So in essence, it is kind of nationalized, sort of. It's kind of like the money going to GM.
Yeah.
And then the government either loses their shirts, which is what's happened in the past because they're throwing money at this, or they will crawl back to profitability.
Well, the weird part in all of this is that report wasn't even like a legit report. It was a CBC thing where they said sources say they had two independent anonymous sources say that this is a condition that the federal government was floating. So it's not even legit in terms of anyone putting their name to it. On top of it all, you had Mark Garneau coming out last week saying we didn't put any pressure on Air Canada to take a deal with Bombardier. Meanwhile, Air Canada also signed a deal with Bombardier to have maintenance work related to the new planes at the Quebec facility, and that's a 20-year deal. The government of Quebec agreed to drop a lawsuit against Air Canada, stemming back to 2012 when it shut down when Air Canada shut down its maintenance subsidiary Avios, and that's a case Quebec was actually winning. Mm-hmm. Air Canada was on its heels in the courtroom on that one, so you can't really tell me that there wasn't any pressure applied when, you know, on this day, everything seemed to be going Bombardier's way except for the 7,000 jobs. I mean, and although, as you said, that kind of went their way too because the stock price went up. I mean, it's not nowhere near where it was 99, 2000, 2001, but an increase is better than a decrease, mm-hmm. for sure.
And that's the thing with airplane maintenance. Somebody finally figured out that, well, it's an airplane. Let's just fly it here where the wages are low and do the maintenance there and then fly it back. No union, no worries, no problem until obviously something – well, hopefully nothing goes wrong. But I don't think that has been proven. But, you know, in a lot of ways, especially when it comes to flight safety, you kind of get what you pay for. But, yeah, I mean, what they will argue is that directly and indirectly, Bombardier employs something like 65,000 people worldwide. So they'll say, oh, well, 7,000 jobs. It's in, I think it was in the railway division. It was like in a division what they're trying to get out of anyway. Yeah. And I think one of the larger layoffs was in Belfast as well.
Yeah.
Well, so, and I did speak about that last week. That's a huge hit for, you know, the UK, Northern Ireland in particular, because it's not exactly, they're not exactly rolling in it. De Havilland, that's the company. De Havilland was the company that was absorbed by Bombardier. And they were huge too. And, you just have this one aerospace company. No offense to other aerospace companies in Canada, but, you know, people think Bombardier. They don't necessarily think Ski-Doo these days. It's all about the planes.
Yeah.
So the burning question, why do we keep propping this thing up? Is it to please the East? Is it just because we can't let it fail? Would it be like a Canada with no NHL teams? You know, would it be like...
Well, somebody pointed out, I can't remember where I heard it. It was on a podcast somewhere. They said, you know, Bombardier is Canada's aerospace industry. It's a sector that is potentially ripe for expansion. Canada can't be a huge player in that, but Canada wants to be a player. What's interesting is, from what I understand, Canada is the only industrialized country that doesn't have a direct stake in its primary aerospace business. So, I mean, that's interesting considering Canada's socialist paradise that our aerospace business isn't officially subsidizing, even though, I mean, considering Bombardier is always coming back looking for another blank check, it is kind of subsidized. But it's not a set-in-stone sort of subsidy. It's not a regular check that's given out either.
Well, I think that, as I'd mentioned with the Avarero, that sort of crushing of it in the 50s was, you know, international forces kind of making it known. It's like, no, we got this. You know, don't bother with your fantastic airplane that was the best of its day.
Yeah.
And then, of course, all of those people were dispersed, and a lot of them went to work with NASA, and a lot of them went to work with other aerospace firms as well.
Yeah.
Moon landing, there was like Avarero people involved with that. So that's – it kind of got squashed. And you're right when you said that, because, well, and a lot of it I think is to do with the military connection.
Right.
And this is probably why we can't get a jet fighter to save our lives, because it's we don't really have the capability to fire one off. But there are lots of nations that do. We don't necessarily have to be directly tied to the States in terms of what jet fighters we have.
Well,
or even domestic airplanes that we have. You know, you get them from Airbus is the one. Airbus laughs at Bombardier. You know. Nice deal, Bombardier, huh? You know, there's competition there, but it's all like, oh, nice one, guys. That's a nice, tidy little deal. But that's, you know, Airbus is massive as well, right?
Yeah.
But if you have to keep subsidizing it, why not sort of semi-nationalize it like the way they are? And I know it's not a solid yet, but that seems to be the way that it's going. And then after this deal is done, what next? Like, what else are we going to bail them out for?
Well, they still want, you know, I think it's $1.5 billion from the federal government. They're still fishing for that.
They'll probably get it. They won't get the whole thing. They might get a good chunk of it, but and then there's just the comparison was made to the Alberta got $250 million. It's like some kind of consolation prize. It's like you win the $649 million. What's the second prize? Oh, it's $250 million just because.
It is.
We love you, Alberta.
You know what does strike me as weird is that as much as people want to praise the open market. When these companies get in trouble, they do show up with their hand out.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and as much as I do feel sorry for people in out west in Saskatchewan, Alberta, who lost their jobs, 100,000 people. And then, you know, when you think about numbers like that as compared to, you know, less than 3,000 altogether in Canada under Bombardier, it's pennies on the dollar. But when you're talking about the oil industry, this it was a business that was boom for years and wasn't planning for the eventual bust, even though the bust is as predictable as, you know, a rainbow after a rainstorm.
As the gold rush was.
Yeah.
Like it's finite. I don't think people appreciate that.
Right. No, exactly.
It tanked in the 80s before once already. Same.
Yes.
Same thing.
And you know, this is the thing is, you know, in aerospace, there's probably more volatility than in oil in terms of, you know, if you're not selling planes, you're not building planes. But on the other hand, what I'll say about Bombardier to wrap up is it's got to – either they've got to – I don't think we can afford the piecemeal the approach anymore where, the, you know, they get in a rut and come to the government for a check and we give them a check and they putter on for another couple of years. You know, they've either got to step up or step out of the way and let it become like a crown corporation. Like I said, if you know, we're going to be given the money, we should be getting money back on that investment. It should be seen as an investment and not just throwing good money after bad.
Must support
them. I'm not a conservative by any means, but it just like, if we're, you know, we're going to be giving them checks, we should be getting something back rather than them coming back in a couple of years for another check.
Yeah, for a company that's making money.
Yes.
Support your local corporate welfare bums. And I didn't come up with that line, but it's true in this case, I think. I mean, if the company is making money, they're making money, they have money in the bank, billions. Why are we giving them money? And I'm definitely not a conservative, as everyone knows. But in doing the research for this, this is a bit of an aside, which I found interesting. I said, did you know Canada had the third satellite ever?
Really?
Sputnik, and then there was the Americans, and then the Alouette. Was the third satellite ever. I mean, it was joint with the U.S., but and of course, mostly government. But then again, NASA was a government project then as well. But 1962, we had the third one ever. And yet now it's like, here's some money for the airplanes.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's a good
step it up, Canada. Kick it up.
We'll be right back with more issues and discussion here on Open Source's Guelph. We're going to take a break now for some music and some PSAs. So we will see you in a couple of minutes. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Hi, my name is Kevin, and back in the 80s, I used to hang around CFRU all the time. Anyone can volunteer here. Just email volunteer at CFRU.ca or visit CFRU.ca for more information.
And that was Union Duke from their album Cash and Carry, and that was Back Song. It's like George W. is on the controls now, eh? Lovely. I wanted to go kind of Texas for that one, but they're not from Texas. They're from Soviet Kanakistan somewhere. I'm not sure where. Anyway, Union Duke, their newish album. It says 2014, but it's new to the station. And I'm looking forward to getting out on my bicycle because I've had enough of this winter crap, so... Thought I'd play that.
I think we've had a cumulative total of like 6 days of winter
this
winter.
It's still too much. It's too much. I get raining in 12. It's my genetic makeup, I think.
Yeah, I love the people who are like, when's spring coming? It's like spring was here last weekend.
That is true, too. That was like minus 20 and then it was plus something.
Well, you know what doesn't come out in spring? apples. And more specifically, the computer type of apple is in a bit of a tiff with the FBI. And if there's one group you probably don't want to be in a tiff with, it's the FBI. But still, Apple is looks like it's they're going to stand their ground legally, so to speak. The FBI wanted them to break the encryption on an iPhone that belonged to Saeed Farouk, who was one of the two San Bernardino shooters who attacked the Christmas party and then had a last stand against the police last December. This is the only one of three phones that they had that survived. The FBI believes there might be critical intelligence to be mined off of it. And the way the encryption is, there's two types of encryption on it, but the most pressing one is it gives you it gives you 10 tries to enter the password of the phone, and then it wipes all the data off the phone. And so the FBI has gone to Apple and said, hey, can you hack this? And Apple's like, no, we're not going to hack it, because then if we – it necessitates them creating a hack that will then work on all previous generations for that generation of iPhone plus all previous generations. The phone that Farouk had was a 5C. So a relatively recent phone, so there are probably a lot of them out there, and it would work for all previous generations of iPhone. Of course, Apple is taking a stand for privacy, saying that if they do invent the hack, it will inevitably get out, and the FBI says, no, do it anyway. And it's kind of a tough one, but I have to admit, between the faceless tyrannical corporation and the faceless tyrannical government, I think my money goes to the corporation. At least the intent. I think I trust their intentions more than I trust the government one. And again, I was listening to a podcast and somebody pointed out it might be easy. This might have been easier to go down if there hadn't been metadata and NSA wiretaps and FISA courts and all that stuff Edward Snowden was talking about just for like the last 16 years. If that hadn't happened, I think there'd probably been a much more receptive public for what's going on here.
Yeah, we call that the Trust No One Department, of which I'm a member. And I also, just as an aside, I was researching this story. I remember as a kid drinking FBI apple juice. I don't know if that means anything, but there's got to be somebody else out there that
– I remember
– FBI apple and FBI orange?
I don't remember drinking it, but I remember it.
Remember seeing it? Yeah.
It was like Fag Industries when you drive down the 401.
Yes. Yeah, that big red sign.
Because when
that's
you go on a field trip to Toronto, you're like, hey, like Fag Industries is coming up.
And they're drinking FBI apple juice.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's a bit of a catch to this that no one's really talking about, at least I don't think so, is that this phone was the guy's work phone.
Right.
It wasn't.
That's true.
It wasn't.
Given to him by the county. And the county actually turned on the encryption.
Oh, they did, because I thought that's why they couldn't. Well, they turned on the encryption, but they also, if they had installed the mobile device management, would have been able to get information off the phone.
That's right.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
I've had work cell phones for a lot of years of varying degrees of security. You know, some of them were big old dumb cell phones, but of the newer ones, and I have a newer one, it's property of the company. So it sounds like they're just kind of staying out of this whole thing. And if they had, you know, done their due diligence, then we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. This go, yeah, okay, FBI, there you go. Because, you know, it's possible that he kept his phones kosher and didn't use this phone. He used this phone for work and his other phone for the more nefarious stuff. And then there was a comment made. It was like, well, using the dead man's thumbprint, which is like of every other sci-fi movie where they like rip a digit or an eyeball off somebody and put it up to the scanner, and then they're able to open it and get to the information. I understand why they want this info, and I also understand the resistance from Apple for this. They're calling it we're not going to give anybody exceptional access. I think what the FBI is saying, they're not just saying, give us the information off this phone. They're saying, we want you to create a backdoor so when this happens again, we can just go into anything and get it. And the problem with that is, as we know, that if you create a backdoor for the FBI or whoever, you know that there's going to be a posse of people somewhere. And the first thing they're going to want to do if they know that that exists, they're going to want to go in there. So all this business of security and encryption bypassed by creating the bypass tool is pointless. It's useless.
And we know Apple isn't a steel drum.
No.
Because of what happened in 2014 with the
leak.
The iCloud leak.
So what I think personally, if they're able, the way it should go would be the company should get the, they can't, they say they can't, mm-hmm. get the information off the phone, give it to the FBI. It's that, right. It should be that simple, but it's gone beyond that. Because I think that they're saying that they can't. I've got a feeling that they probably can. I have no doubt that somebody at Apple knows how to do that. They have to be able to. There's no possible way that it's that tightly encrypted, or am I dreaming?
I don't think that's true. But I was reading some tech guys, and their argument was, we can't believe that the FBI doesn't have guys
that are able
who can't
to do,
do
it.
This, or at least be able to search out online tools. And there, I can't remember who it was, but somebody was who was a security expert was saying the tools are probably out there for them to do this.
Oh yeah,
and perhaps like what's holding them up is, you know, manpower and resources, which, you know, probably being at the FBI are probably enormously taxed. Like if you wanted to put 10 guys on it for 3 weeks, they could probably do it. But who has that kind of time? And perhaps they just felt it would be more direct to go directly to Apple and say, hey, yo, hook us up with the data.
And maybe there's a bit of showmanship going on here, saying, you know, we're gonna take them to the map because we want this.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe it's possible that they've already unlocked it. I don't know. I wouldn't put it past them because it's the FBI, right?
Right.
But it also seems what's lacking as well by the sounds of it from what I was reading is that laws governing this are ancient. And in fact, the All Writs Law,
right,
which goes back to 1798, and I think it is like anything that you have written with your quill pen regarding whatever they're talking about, you have to cough it up. Obviously a completely different universe from now. So it sounds like there's a joint effort going on right now in Congress, bipartisan committee, trying to legislate this and determine what's going to happen. I mean, look how fast the legislation happened after 9/11.
Right.
It was instant, just to add water. I don't know if this is going to be this instant, but they are working on it now in that this needs to be dealt with because it's only going to get deeper and deeper. It's not just Apple. It's everything we touch now. The cyberland, cyber world,
well, think
needs
of it,
cyber rules, right?
Think of it like this. 10 years ago, this would not have been an issue at all because there was no such thing as an iPhone.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how sort of new, when you're talking about laws going back to the 1780s, that's how new this is.
Yep.
There was no such thing as an iPhone 10 years ago. And even just, you know, the Supreme Court, I think it was last year, there was that decision about police having to get a warrant in order to search the contents of your smartphone. Because this came from a couple of cases in California that police could just take your phone and look at it and look at your stuff in it. And people quite rationally, I think, said, well, you know, what's on your life is on your phone now.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of personal contacts. And,
yeah, like
and
if you're calling ISIS.
And, yeah.
On your work phone.
You know, your social media, you know, some of which is private.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can set your Facebook privacy to, you know, just people you know. You know, there is definitely a lag in the law. But your previous point is interesting about because somebody said Privacy and Big Data Institute, which is a thing, said that
sounds made up.
No, it is a thing though.
Big data.
Government is using a quote unquote sympathetic case to push their power boundaries, and because, you know, 14 people were killed, sprayed with gunfire at a Christmas party by ISIS sympathizers. The government's like, well, who's going to have a problem with this? And it, you know, it turns out a lot of people might have a problem with it. It's like, yeah, Saeed Farouk and his wife were horrible people, you know, and dastardly murdered innocent people for, you know, really no good reason. But I mean, there are longstanding implications for you and me, maybe not you, because to follow the tease I put on the website is you're the one with the BlackBerry still.
Oh, well, yeah, that's true.
But
it's working beautifully, by the way. Well, and could probably be hacked very easily. Not that I have anything to hack on it, but it really isn't.
But, I mean, there is – well, I'm the worst. I still have an iPhone 4. But, for those of us who are a bit more innocent, you know, they always tell you, even if you don't have even if you're innocent, you don't have anything to hide, you know, when they tell you your rights and, you know, and this is from, like, the singular – high school law class I took. You shut up. You have the right to remain silent.
Yeah.
Use it. Just because you're innocent doesn't mean you have to start talking, because who knows what they can hang.
That's number one. Don't
just
tell them your name and address. That's all you have to tell them. You don't have to tell them anything else.
Yeah.
That's a hot tip. But at the same time,
the experienced criminals
that we are. Yeah. There's a story there. At the same time, I still feel that they, considering the circumstances, that somebody, maybe not even the FBI,
mm-hmm.
San Bernardino Police, should be able to get at this specific information. And with the catch that it was his work phone.
Yeah.
That it was. It's not – a work phone is not your property. 100% not yours.
Yeah.
He destroyed his own phone knowing full well that – yeah, and they're probably working on that too, trying to get stuff off of that, even though it was probably smashed with hammers or whatever. The work phone isn't, and there are lots of people, like, our work phones had long distance, and then they took it away because they thought it was being abused, which it wasn't. But, you know, to call Kitchener from here is long distance, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're calling somebody about work or whatever, you can't do it now, and they're able to do that. And it can also be taken away at any time.
True enough.
Yeah, so that's, will they get the info? We'll find out tomorrow what Apple has to say. But I think they should just do some kind of quiet side deal and take care of it without having the pissing contest in the media.
Apparently, to make a final point, apparently there are 12 other cases.
I think did they not give them information on some of them? Have I got that right? Or like the older phones were easier to – you could just get information off them.
They're trying to
protect proprietary stuff, right?
Well, yeah. But there are 12 other cases where Apple has refused. Like this isn't
the first time,
but there are 12 other cases where they've refused.
But
of course, they've also helped before too.
I guess so.
Anyway.
Well, you can't do it for one, not the other. It's all or nothing.
True.
Anyway.
Speaking of helping, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, David Cameron, fulfilling a campaign promise, has launched the referendum to decide whether the United Kingdom is going to stay in the European Union or leave the European Union. It will take place on June the 23rd. And although I think there is a – you might know better than me, Scotty. From what I understand, there's kind of an even split amongst the people in terms of – what they think. It seems to be all kind of a one-sided affair amongst politicians and the, shall we say, establishment in terms of whether they want to stay or go. They want to stay.
I think one of the most interesting things that's going to come out of this is to watch the Conservative Party in the UK possibly implode over this.
Yeah.
Because that's possibly where the deepest division is. And the pressure from the backbench of the Conservatives in the UK has been to not just to do this. So what will happen is, should there be a yes vote, Cameron has just negotiated a list of demands from the EU, and supposedly they will be implemented.
And it's a pretty sweet list.
Yeah, it's and some of this, it's some of those the usual things like we want to cut red tape or whatever, but it's also we want to keep benefits away from refugees, the kinds of things he's like, what, really? This is what you're negotiating about?
Yeah.
And people not being able to, on migrants only being able to stay on welfare for a certain period of time. And, other things like keeping the pound and keeping London in its little bubble, which is pretty much a country in and of itself, the way it works in the world. So that's a pretty stark division. Boris Johnson, mayor of London, Londonium or whatever, has come out to leave the EU. And there are others too, including Nigel Farage of UKIP, who, I mean, he's been on about it for, he was a member of the European Parliament, and he's been on about it for years. Because one of the things is the amount of money that gets vacuumed up by the European Parliament. You can point that it's something like 350 million pounds a week or something just to maintain this. Mm-hmm. So you can point to that and say, well, what do we – this is one of the – well, I'll say one of the conservative concerns, but should be everyone's concern. What do they get for their money, right? Mm-hmm. That's a lot of cake. But they do get quite a bit for their money because being part of that community opens up some – like I think 50% of their exports go within that community and are governed by those rules. And if it is indeed a no vote, part of the problem or the difficulty is going to be – and there are other countries that have done this. I think Switzerland is one of them. They have to negotiate everything with every individual country. And it's doable, but – if you think about the amount of bureaucracy that creates, are you really saving that much money? I don't know. And today Cameron's coming out saying, well, you know, the prices in the shops are going to be higher.
Right.
And your vacation is going to be higher and everything's going to be higher. But Thatcher, back 40 years ago, they had a referendum as well. And it was resounding to stay in what was the European community then.
Mm-hmm.
And Thatcher, I believe she was in opposition at that point, was very much for staying in the community. And I guess, you know, when you look at it from that kind of conservative right-wing free trade approach to everything,
right,
it makes sense. But it looks like all of the parties, the majority of the parties, Labour Party, Scottish National Party, Plaid Cymru, the Liberal Democrats are all for staying as well. So politically, you've got this body that wants to stay, but the referendum may change that.
Yeah, and this is the thing with referendums, though. And then, of course, remember Scotland had a referendum last year,
mm-hmm.
a pretty big referendum. Referendums tend to favor the status quo, although the numbers right now, there was an online survey that was 43% stay versus 39% leave, which suggests there's, you know, a pretty big block of undecideds. And then there was an Ipsos Mori poll that said 54% stay and 36% leave. So it's unless like some people really start changing their minds in the next couple of months, I think the end of this is pretty much telegraphed. Boris Johnson, character in his own right, is probably the most well-known anti or pro-leaving person. And, of course, him and Cameron have got into it already. And
they were chums.
Yeah.
Eton or Oxford. They all went to school together.
Like wherever school rich buddies. Guys go in Britain to school.
Yeah, the network.
The network, exactly. And, you know, Cameron's slamming him like, oh, you're just trying to climb the ladder and use this for your own political ambitions. And Boris Johnson's like, shut up, Cameron. And...
They're going at her, and that's what I was saying. That's what's going to be most interesting is watching them, if it gets nasty, which it probably will.
Yeah, I mean,
potentially implode.
Well, this came up because in the election, because Cameron was being pushed to have something like this. I don't think he wants to have something like this. I don't think he wants to be expending political capital trying to fight this fight.
No, but it was an election promise.
It was an election promise, I know, but because it was his arm was being twisted by people in his backbench, and we'll remember because we covered this, mm-hmm. it was a tight election. I mean, it was kind of a landslide for the Conservatives in the end, but that was by no means prophesized in the campaign. So, of course, he's going to try and consolidate his own base. But, if you know, he's come up pretty strong being favored, even though he has five people in his cabinet who are anti-EU.
Mm-hmm.
So this is you're right about this being a potential gong show for the Conservative Party.
Yeah, and one of the predictions has come true already. One of the things that we're saying was that the pound will slump, you know, on Britain leaving or United Kingdom leaving the European community. And that's exactly what happened. The pound has hit a 7-year low this week. Mm. It's down like $1.30 or something US, $1.39. So, you know, they can point to that and say, look, it's already happening. And of course, there's the usual things where they're predicting growth will fall because, you know, you've pulled out of this long-standing agreement. And housing and banking, housing's sort of tanking there already. But, well, it's expensive, but it's... you know, in terms of people profiting from it,
Yeah, well, London's one of the most expensive places in the world. But yeah, there's long term implications too, or short term and long term. Cameron pointed out that there was an economic slowdown in terms of deals getting done during the Scottish referendum because people were unsure. From a purely theoretical basis, that Scotland was going to stay, and he's saying that there's going to be some blowback for the next several months as the countdown to the referendum. People not sure if they're going to invest in the UK if they're not going to be part of the EU anymore, and the projections that the UK could lose 2.2% in GDP by 2030 if they leave the EU, which is kind of huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, you're talking about GDP. You're talking about billions and billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars.
And people getting excited over growth of 1%, right? It's like, oh, my God, it went up. Yeah, like,
well, that's just it. They're saying if staying in the EU could add an additional 1.6% of growth to Britain's GDP, which, again, given the economic circumstances and just given the amount of money we're talking about, it's huge.
Yeah, and this may also, speaking of Scotland, may prompt another referendum, because even though the SNP are for staying, they're arguing, and some in Scotland are arguing, that, okay, if the UK votes to leave, then we should have the right to be able to vote to be a separate nation and able to align ourselves. And when I say ourselves, I mean Scotland, to stay in the EU. So they would be independent from the UK and then rejoin the EU. So it's odd in terms of, I don't know if they're playing both sides, sort of. They're saying, well, we want to stay, but if the voters go, we're going to vote to be separate, so then we can stay. So everybody's got their own, you know, agenda, I suppose, in
this.
Well,
it sets up a fascinating dynamic. What's more important to Scotland, being part of the UK or being part of the EU?
Probably sure economically the EU.
Yeah.
For sure. Oh, yeah, because it's – you want me to get on the milk crate about London vacuuming the money from the north? Yeah, that kind of thing. There's a line. There's a line. Anyway.
There is. But, I mean, we're
– we're going to cross it. No. It's like the Rubicon, man.
Well, I mean, I was going to say we have a couple of months to talk about this again and to revisit it. So it's – I mean,
it's going to get hot. It's going to get hot.
It's already hot, and this is just like the first week.
Red hot.
But yeah, so it can only get hotter.
Because we love red hot.
I think.
Yes.
Yes. I was taken aback.
We're going to create our own community.
I was taken aback by it. It's going to get red hot. We love red hot.
Red hots.
Anyway.
Smoking hot.
Since it is almost dinner time, maybe.
Yeah, I guess we're thinking food now.
Red hots. Yeah. Anyway, that is all for this week's edition of Open Sources Guelph. You can stay connected to us all week long through our website, opensourcesguelph.com. Go to Open Sources Newswire on Facebook. And speaking of that, we skipped the Guelph beat portion this week, but if you have something Guelph-related you'd like us to talk about, or someone Guelph-related you'd like us to have in, feel free to pipe up. We're actually going to try and get some local politicians in and do that due diligence for you.
We're going to give everybody their 15 minutes.
Exactly. We are on Twitter at @OS_Guelph, and we are on Podbean, the Guelph Politicast channel. You can download Open Sources there and listen to it anywhere on whatever you listen to find podcasts on. And you can connect with me personally at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter. Go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
At Scotty Hertz on Twitter. Scotty Hertz on the Facebook. And Spannerbook is where I blog. And there's a thing there.
Well, there you go.
New ones to follow. New ones being released weekly. It's so old-fashioned, but
it is.
That's how I roll. I type the whole thing on my BlackBerry. Yeah. Nah, I didn't.
Waterloo proud.
He's a typewriter. Yeah.
Stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back here next week with more Open Sources Thursday at 5 p.m. And we will see you then for more Hot Topics.